Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on in 2020. So what I'm going to talk about today is what I talked about last week. This war against the Palestinians by the Israelis and COP28 and the climate crisis. So one thing that happened in the last week is that the UN General Assembly approved a ceasefire resolution by a vote of 153 to 10 to 23 abstentions. And of course, the US was one of the countries that voted no. But I think we have to realize we're having an impact. There are a lot of reports that Biden officials are telling Israel to end the bombing by the end of the year. Bernie Sanders, who was not for a ceasefire, is now calling for a ceasefire and introduced a privilege resolution for a human rights report from the State Department. Now, there's a law that says we can't provide arms to countries that violate human rights. Now, we violate that law all the time, but Congress can try to enforce it. And by a privilege resolution, I'm not sure how this works, but Sanders only needs, 50% plus one to pass it. It's not likely it'll pass, but that's movement. And the thing I would say is you need to contact your House representative while they're home during this Christmas recess and keep the pressure on and then be out on the streets for these demonstrations. We need ceasefire. And as I've been saying, that's not enough. We need to push for negotiations for a political resolution using international law as the lever. And that's Resolution 242. That's the two-state solution. But the point is to get the negotiations going. And whether it ends up as a one secular democratic state or two states or a two-state confederation with open borders, I mean, those are all the main three models that are out there. The point is to stop bombing and start talking. And that's really what we got to push. Or otherwise, you may get a ceasefire, but there'll be the war will resume. And Israel keeps pushing the Palestinians, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank. I mean, there's just terrible. If you go look for it, you find videos of, pushing Palestinians out of their homes, out of their villages, journalists being assaulted and beat up by the Israeli Defense Forces, backing these settlers who, are going after Palestinian land. So, the issue before Congress, and the senators are still negotiating, the House is going home, but I think they want to link, and this was Biden's idea, to link aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, and immigration reform. And Biden thought, well, we'll throw in immigration reform to appease the Republicans, but they're not appeasable. They, are pushing for more and more draconian, racist immigration laws. And of course, they're hypocritical as can be because they're the ones that said we want regular order and voting on each policy or law independently. But now they're linking aid to Israel and Ukraine, which most of them want to give, to draconian changes in immigration law. And unfortunately, Biden and the top Democrats appear to be accommodating them. I mean, these compromises include Title 42-like authority to summarily expel migrants without hearings, without even the public health excuse during the COVID pandemic, which got us Title 42. Mandatory detention of migrants, that's mass incarceration in sprawling concentration camps of people who want to apply for residency or asylum. And then the expansion of fast-track deportations. So we are not, like the Statue of Liberty says, a refuge. We are becoming, Fortress America against migrants, even though most people in America are descendants of immigrants. So what, Biden is willing to do is codify what Trump and his racist aide, Stephen Miller, did. And it's about cruelty. It's about inflicting harm, separating families, and in the larger population, instilling fear and hatred of immigrants, which is a divide and rule strategy of the far right. Now, if I was in Congress at this point, I said last week, I think I'd vote for it because Ukraine needs the aid. But at this point, I would vote it down. The immigration policies are racist to the core. Israel has more than enough arms to defend itself. And, you know, from reading I've been doing, Ukraine's going to fight on whether the U.S. gives them arms or not, because Europe is going to provide them with arms. I know there's a snafu in the EU with this guy, this right-winger Orban out of Hungary, but they will independently of the UN provide that arms rather than jointly, independently of the EU, if the U.S. abandons them. I mean, the EU has already given more to Ukraine than the U.S. has. It's been more on the economic and humanitarian aid side than the weapons side, but they've also placed less restraints on the use of weapons and the types of weapons and the tactics. And without U.S. support, you know, what Ukraine may do is take the war to Russia and to Belarus, where there's a restive population that would like to overthrow Alexander Lukashenko, who stole the last election with the help of Russian tanks. And these are tactics that Ukraine, that U.S. wouldn't let Ukraine do, but if the U.S. isn't supporting them, they may do it. I mean, the one thing that's for sure is Ukraine is not going to be taken over by Russia without a fight. And those who say that, you know, if the U.S. cuts off arms to Ukraine, it's going to lead to peace, they're fools. I mean, Russia keeps attacking Ukraine, and it will do so if it's, you know, especially if it's disarmed. And Putin had his, you know, annual press conference this week, which he skipped last year because of the bad news from Ukraine. He was, his forces were getting, you know, they lost a lot of ground in the fall last year. This year they had it, and he repeated, I have the same objectives, and there won't be peace until we reach them. Denazification, which is code for killing Zelensky and the leaders of Ukraine, and, you know, Ukrainian nationalists, their leadership, their intellectuals, their politicians, their technicians. And then secondly, demilitarization, which means taking over the whole country and Russia being able to control Ukraine. And then the third thing is neutrality, which means the Russian puppet state like Belarus, if not complete annexation. So this war is not going to stop until Putin realizes he can't win due to Ukrainian resistance. I think that's the reality that people need to face. I would vote for the Ukrainian aid if it was a separate bill, but not with it bundled together with these racist immigration policies and bombs for Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinians. And I do mean genocide. I mean, Israeli apartheid is different than South African apartheid because it doesn't need the native indigenous population. That's why Israel imported all those Thais who work on their farms, and many of whom, you know, were captured as hostages by Hamas and Islamic Jihad. What Israel wants is not the labor of the Palestinians. It wants their land from the river to the sea. And that they want it for themselves, and they want the Palestinians out. Certainly the right wing in power in Israel wants that. Not every Israeli, but the left that has wanted peaceful coexistence in some form or other is extremely weak in Israel these days. The right has really taken over, not just the government, but the political culture. And, you know, that's why it's going to take international pressure to force Israel to accommodate human rights and political equality for the Palestinians. So whether it's one state, two states, or a two-state confederation with open borders, the point is we've got, and the U.S. can play a lot of leverage in this, you know, force Israel to the negotiating table as well as the Palestinian side. And we have leverage there because we provide a lot of funding for the Palestinian Authority. As I said before, both sides need new elections so they have legitimate partners. The Palestinians haven't had elections since 2006, and neither Hamas or Fatah is very popular. Most people don't like the corruption of the Palestinian Authority, which Fatah controls, or the fundamentalism of Hamas. They want other options. And so, but it needs to be an election with proportional representation. So all sides, not a plurality like Hamas got in 2006 because of single-member districts, which enabled them to get the majority on the legislative council. It needs to be proportional representation, so everybody feels they have a stake. And then on the Israeli side, Netanyahu's popularity is in the hole. It's under the hole. It's he couldn't win another election. So I think that's something that we need to be pushing. So the main thing is push for the ceasefire, talk to your House representatives, and be out on the streets with these demonstrations. As I said, I think they're making a difference. Now, the other big thing that happened early in the week was COP28 finally came out with a what they call a stock take, like taking stock. And, you know, COP should maybe be called the Conference of the Polluters instead of the Conference of the Parties, because there were 70,000 people in attendance there. Just think of the carbon footprint of all these people flying from all over the world to Dubai. And several thousand of those were oil and gas executives and lobbyists. And so they had a big debate on wording in this final statement. Were they going to phase down or phase out fossil fuels? And the petrostates and Gulf monarchies and Russia resisted even saying fossil fuels, which they had never said before. Think about that. Almost 30 years of these conferences, and they still haven't said, you know, we got to get rid of fossil fuels or cut back on them to stop this climate crisis. So the petrostates argued that the statement should focus on emissions instead of fossil fuels themselves, and we're promoting big time carbon capture and storage, which would allow the continued use of fossil fuels. What they came up with, the language is, quote, transitioning away from fossil fuels. So the good thing is it's the first time they ever identified fossil fuels. The problem is there's no hard timetable or even obligation on any country to make the transition. So the countries, the petrol states, the oil and gas producers and coal producers and the energy companies remain free to continue producing and burning fossil fuels. Now, there's some other elements to the final statement. They said they want to reach zero carbon emissions by 2050, of course, zero carbon rather than just zero, real zero, assumes that there'll still be fossil fuel burning with carbon capture and sequestration. They said they want to triple renewable energy production by 2030, which the U.S. and China already said in their recent get-together out in California. It's ambitious. It's certainly possible, technically. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the fossil fuels will replace, or the renewables will replace the fossils. It could just add to energy capacity, which is what's been happening to a large degree, is renewables have been growing by leaps and bounds in recent years because they're cheaper to build than fossil fuel generators or nuclear power plants. They say they want to double energy efficiency. They say they want to cut methane emissions. One thing they emphasize, they want to accelerate carbon capture and sequestration, which is their excuse to keep burning fossil fuels. They also said they want to increase the use of quote unquote transition fuels, which is just code for fossil gas. An earlier draft of the agreement had urged nations to stop issuing permits for new coal-fired power plants. And then it added, unless they could capture and bury the carbon. But China and India, which are still building large new coal plants to satisfy their growing energy demand, oppose that language, and it was dropped in the final version. So, you know, there's a lot of words here, but actions speak louder than words. And where we're at is global emissions are at record levels. After 30 years of these damn conferences, we're still burning more fossil fuels than ever. Coal burning is at a record level. Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, the Saudi energy minister, said that the agreement, quote, buried the issue immediately of immediately phasing out or phasing down fossil fuels. And instead, quote, left space for countries to choose their own way. In other words, Saudi Arabia is going to go right ahead producing oil and gas and selling it to countries that consume it, like China and the U.S., although we're producing so much, we don't need to import it, we export it. And then the U.S. role in all this, John Kerry, the Biden climate envoy, actually got to the point, which he hadn't before, that he supported phase out in the wording. But the practical, the action as opposed to the words, is the U.S. projects or U.S. projects make up more than a third of all new and gas, all new oil and gas extraction planned worldwide through 2050. So we're the biggest criminal in this. And, you know, Kerry and the U.S. were pushing carbon capture and sequestration, which is the loophole that the oil and gas industry thinks they have to keep producing and burning fossil fuels. The U.S. has no plans to place any limits on oil and gas production by these giant oil and gas companies. In fact, Biden has approved more oil and gas drilling permits on public lands in his first 2 years than Trump did. Even though Trump, you know, he was saying the other day, drill, drill, drill. And of course, that broke Biden's campaign promise to stop drilling on public lands. There was a production gap report released last month by the UN Environment Program in alliance with some other environmental groups. And it found that the world is on track to produce 110% more fossil fuels than is consistent with keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise. And that's 50% chance of keeping it below 1.5 degrees. The carbon budget for that is 250 billion tons. This year, the world is burning 40 billion tons. Do the math, and you'll see that we just have 6 years. If we keep burning at this rate, that's 2030. We're going to blow past this threshold where the scientists say we have a 50% chance of staying below the 1.5 degree Celsius limit. And to reach that, emissions would have to reach net zero by 2034. I mean, that's just not in the plans of any country right now. And the actual track, as I said before, is 110% more than that. That's more than double what is the remaining carbon budget to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And what that means, other studies show, is that we're about to reach the tipping points that would permanently alter the way the planet's climate system works. In other words, beyond the point of no return. And these tipping points include a widespread thawing of the permafrost, which will accelerate the release of carbon and methane that has been captured and frozen in the northern regions, you know, subarctic regions and Arctic regions. And it would mean the collapse of the big ice sheets in Greenland and West Antarctica. And what that will do, because it will dilute the salinity in the North Atlantic and it caused the collapse, and that would prevent, it's called the North, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is this belt of water that it goes from the Indian Ocean up to the North Atlantic and back. And when it gets up near Greenland, because you get the hot water starts to cool and then it drops and then it goes back toward the Indian Ocean. And what that do is heat up the North Atlantic, particularly Europe, and it cools the South Atlantic. And if that circulation stops, and studies say it could stop as early as 2025, certainly by the end of this century. And what that would do is change the weather in Europe, much colder, in the South Atlantic, much hotter, causing devastation to agriculture in both the North and South Atlantic countries, and cause massive climate refugee migrations. So we're right on the cusp of those things. Meanwhile, you know, there was some talk, but not much action on climate finance. The Global South is saying if there's no finance for them, they can't phase out fossil fuels because they don't have the resources to do it. Many of these countries they're paying more in debt payments to the North than they can invest in their own economies. And if the transition is not funded for the poor countries, there's not going to be a transition. Yet the U.S. and Kerry fought to remove all references to rich countries providing finance. And, you know, half the world lives in places where debt payments exceed spending on education and healthcare. So without the finance, you know, there's no realistic plans. Now, they decided they would put the next COP, COP 29 in Azerbaijan, which is a petrostate that just ethnically cleansed 100,000 Armenians from a region where they've lived for the last 2,500 years since the 7th century BC. And Russia had troops there. They were defending the Armenians from the Azerbaijanis, but they decided to switch sides because of geopolitics. Armenia opposes and Azerbaijan supports Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And leading up to Azerbaijan being chosen, Russia vetoed several East European countries that were suggested because they had opposed the invasion of Ukraine. So they're going to Azerbaijan. So, you know, basically COP, the Conference of Polluters, remains a spectacle and a farce. So, you know, what we got to do is we got to keep pushing Green Party street politics and electoral politics for an eco-socialist and global Green New Deal. U.S. has the resources. It sets the tone in the markets as well as politically. And we must demand that the U.S. transform itself into the world's humanitarian and ecological superpower instead of being its militaristic superpower, and make friends instead of enemies, and save the planet for all of us. That's what we got to be, you know, pushing. And we're not getting it from the Democrats or Republicans. And if we don't do it, nobody is. So we need to stay active on the street and in the elections. So that's my little rant. And looking forward to your comments and questions. Amy L. Sachs, rich people just have to fly everywhere while they wag their fingers at us and whine that we're the problem. Yeah, Oxfam recently came out with a study that says the top 1% consumes half the world's energy, and the bottom 50% consumes just 8% of it. So rich people are an environmental problem. I guess that's the way to put it. Amy L. Sachs, more green candidates on this show next year? Yes. Also, does anyone know if Stein has named a running mate yet, or why that one Labor multi-candidate debate is excluding her? Okay, Stein has not named a running mate. She did suggest, and I think what was her first interview after announcing, that she's open to having Cornel West, who she asked to run in 2016 with her. And it makes sense, and this is the way Jill explained it, I think it makes sense. Cornel West is not going to be on many ballots. There's reporting this week that Robert Kennedy Jr. Has a super PAC that's putting $15 million into his ballot access. Cornel West, according to reports this week, has raised $500,000 since he started. He reported about a little over $300,000 in his quarterly report, which was for the end of September. So he's had, you know, 2.5 more months. And if he's only raised $200,000 in that period, he's not going to get the money he needs to get on a ballot. If he ran with Jill, he could focus on his strength, which is public speaking to the media and, you know, to public events, and let, you know, Jill's organization take care of the campaign organization and raising the money. And so that would make sense. They have similar politics, and the two of them would be, you know, be pretty high profile, as high a profile as we could expect from the Green Party. And then that Labor multi-candidate debate, that's something the Teamsters hosted yesterday and today, with five candidates. It included Kennedy, it included Cornel West, it included Asa Hutchinson from the Republican Party, Marianne Williamson from the Democratic Party, and that guy, Dean Phillips, a Democrat, who's talking about running against Biden. But this is just the first of several. And I tweeted that they should have included Jill. She's the most pro-labor candidate. And she'll be on the ballot. Most of those candidates in that debate will not. You know, Kennedy's probably the only one that will in November next year. And I also sent a message as a retired Teamster to the Teamsters office on their, you know, their form on their website that they should include Jill. Now, they plan to do more of these, and I expect Jill will be included. So, you know, stay tuned for that. But, you know, if they're including these candidates in this first round, most of whom are not going to be on the ballot in November, you know, they'd be really blowing it if they didn't include Jill. And so I think I'm hopeful she'll be in the next round that the Teamsters do. Gay from Rhode Island, Devin. I guess that's Devin. Why am I not running for president again? Oh, man, I've run 25 times. Look, I my campaign team from 2020, I did think about it before Cornel West stepped up because we just didn't have any serious candidates. And I know what it takes to run a campaign. Definitely have things to say. But my campaign team from 2020, you know, most of them are young people, new jobs, new kids. Two of them who are older passed away. So I would have had to start from scratch pulling a campaign together. And that's a lot of work. And, you know, I've been focusing on commenting on the need for ranked choice voting and proportional representation and doing Ukraine solidarity work and now Palestine solidarity work. There's a lot you can do without running for office. So when Cornel West stepped up, I really felt it. I felt so relieved because I guess I was not looking forward to trying to put together a campaign. So it was basically for logistical reasons. When I ran in 2020, the campaign team had come together and they wanted a left green to run. And they approached me and it still took them about 4 months to convince me. So that was a different circumstance. So I'm not saying I won't run again, but not this time. I'm supporting Jill. I have some criticisms of her Ukraine policy. I think Cornell would be a good vice presidential candidate. I have criticisms of his Ukraine policy too, but given the alternatives, I mean, it's either that or Genocide Joe, because, you know, that's really the only options. And I think as Cornel West now agrees, and I was arguing in 2020, you cannot fight the rising fascism on the right in the Republican Party with this neoliberal austerity that we get from the Democrats. That just creates the opportunity for the right to scapegoat immigrants and people of color and women and gay people and trans people. And it's been successful. And the Democrats, because people have economic insecurities due to the Democratic policies, are just laying the ground for the Republicans to do this divide and rule scapegoating. So that's why we need a left alternative. We probably won't win, almost certainly won't win the presidency, but we can change the debate. And we've done that. Independent parties on the left have done that since the Liberty Party ran against slavery in 1840. And, you know, the populists in Greenback Labor and the People's Party did it in the late 19th century, taking on corporate monopolies. The socialists did it by proposing labor reforms and social insurance, which we got in the New Deal. And then the Green Party, we made a Green New Deal our signature issue in the 2010s. And, you know, the progressive Democrats have picked it up. It's now a national term of debate. Of course, the progressive Democrats watered it down, like the Democrats always do. You know, they eliminated the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure. They eliminated the phase out of nuclear power. They eliminated the cuts in military spending to help fund the Green New Deal. They extended the deadline for zero emissions from, you know, a decade from now, we were saying 2030 and 2020, to 2050, and changed the definition from real zero to net zero, which, of course, as I was saying, opens the door for fossil fuels. And then what they've actually put into legislation, aside from the non-binding Green New Deal, which I was just criticizing, and it's never been voted on because neither Pelosi or now, what's his name down there in Brooklyn, Hakeem Jeffries, will put her on the floor for a vote. And the Republicans did put it on. McConnell did put it on the Senate side. And most of the Democrats voted against it with the Republicans. And then the bills that have been put in, or the climate action that have been put in and supported by these progressive Democrats, is really a neoliberal approach to climate action. Instead of public programs, public enterprises that can actually carry out a rapid transition to 100% clean energy and then zero moving toward negative emissions, they provide subsidies and tax incentives for the private corporations that got us in this mess in the first place. And that's hit or miss. And it's missing in some respects, like with offshore wind right now, with the high interest rates, a lot of these investors are saying, not now, we got to wait till the interest rates come down, which it looks like they're starting to, but that's a delay and we don't have time to delay. Or take steel. You know, most of the steel is produced with coke ovens. And the steel corporations are not going to replace those coke ovens with electric arc furnaces and hydrogen furnaces until they wear out the coke ovens. What you need are public enterprises that say, we can't be producing or using more fossil fuels. We got to make the transition now. And it'll cut into profits. But, you know, the whole idea of an eco-socialist Green New Deal is you make the investments now, and then you're producing a lot of things that will have a return on investment. Renewable energy, people will pay their electric rates. Public housing, people will pay their rents. And the other things that will be produced from, you know, the components for solar panels and wind generators, they will get paid by those that, you know, assemble and install those things. And then they'll get paid by people paying their electric rates. So in the long run, it will pay for itself. And we can't let short-term profits for corporations determine what we can actually do to deal with the climate change. So the question was, why aren't I running for president? Boy, I'd be hitting on that. We need an eco-socialist Green New Deal. We need peace policies, particularly nuclear disarmament initiatives. And we need an economic bill of rights to provide everybody with economic security and a life above poverty. Those are the three things I ran on in 2020. This time I would also run on ranked choice voting and proportional representation. Until we change the electoral system so that the Greens are represented in proportion to their support, we're going to be marginal in all except local elections, where actually we are pretty successful. We won over half the races we ran last year. I think it was 40 out of 79. The thing we should be doing is running a lot more of those local races and creating a political base. And from there, going to the state legislature and the House of Representatives. So that's what I'm going to advocate, but I'm not running for office on that platform this time. Ashley R., nuclear power by way of fusion is the cleanest form of renewable energy. Yeah, and we already have a fusion reactor. It's called the Sun. It gives us solar energy, it gives us wind energy because that solar heat creates the winds. We don't need to spend a lot of money and take decades to produce fusion on the Earth when we already got it in the sky. So I don't mind research on fusion, but a practical application, you know, from the optimists is, say, it's still decades away. That's too late for dealing with the climate crisis. Janelle, a plant in Illinois is making hydrogen fuel cells and retrofitting existing diesel trucks. Each truck will carry a 50 kilogram tank of hydrogen. What do you say about hydrogen fuel cell infrastructure? We should be producing green hydrogen, but only for certain uses. It's a more expensive way to store energy. That's what hydrogen does. You separate the H in H2O water from the 2O, the oxygen, and you get hydrogen, but that takes energy. But then when hydrogen recombines with oxygen, you get power. And you can generate electricity with that, or heat. And so, but because it's not as efficient as other ways of storing energy, batteries, compressed air, pumping water into a reservoir and then running that water down into a hydro generator, we should save the hydrogen for where it's needed. Like I mentioned, steel production, hydrogen to create heat instead of coke for steel making is a use that is the cleanest way of making steel. And then in terms of long range transportation, ships as well as trucks, there's a certain point at which hydrogen becomes cheaper than batteries. And so building trucks or retrofitting diesel trucks with hydrogen is good for long distance trucking. And I think the crossover point is like 2,000 miles. I may be wrong about that. What's his name? Mark Jacobson at Stanford has done those calculations. And I think he said maybe 1,500 or 2,000 miles is where it becomes cheaper to use hydrogen fuel cells instead of electric batteries. So we need to build the infrastructure of producing the hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells, but just not think of it as, the way to store energy for everything we want to do, because there are more efficient ways of storing energy to produce electricity than storing hydrogen. More efficient in terms of the energy cost and the actual cost itself. Andrew Hager, remember when I asked about eco-friendly land development, Howie? Could the same concept apply to rebuilding abandoned railroads into eco-friendly preservation railroads for tourist trains? Yeah, I think so. I think you're a fan of old-fashioned steam engines, which, maybe here and there, for old time's sake or nostalgia. But electric rails is what we really want. And there are lots of rail lines that have been abandoned because until a car came along, this country was networked with both wide gauge rails for long distance travel and freight, as well as narrow gauge trolleys that, I know here in upstate New York, all the cities were networked. In fact, let's see if you can, right here, this map right here, you really can't see it well, but that is a map of the trolley system that Syracuse, here where I'm at, had in 1903. And anywhere in the city was no more than two blocks from a trolley, and they came by every 10 minutes. Much more efficient than our bus system now, which is, it takes hours to, go a couple miles to get downtown from, the outer neighborhoods. It's just not what we used to have. We've gone backwards in terms of public transportation, not just in Syracuse, but in most cities in the country. So yeah, rebuilding the rails is part of the Green New Deal. And we say we need a public transportation company that will do that. The Rail Workers United, which is a caucus, a reform caucus of the Railroad Workers Unions, has been calling to nationalize the railroads and take them out of the hands of these for-profit corporations, which are understaffing the railroads, which is dangerous. And actually, we're going in the opposite way. There is a Cincinnati happened to own a railroad. I think it came from somewhere in the South. And they just sold it to get some quick cash, and the city approved it in a referendum. That's too bad. We should be going the other way. Make the railroad system a public utility that operates at cost for public benefit instead of for the private profits of big investors like Warren Buffett, who owns one of the big railroad companies. Violated Content Boutique. There's a lot of progress with sand batteries for storing heat energy. That's it stores the heat, then the heat is used to generate the electricity as opposed to a, what you really think of as a battery, if I understand the sand batteries. But yeah, you, the sand stores heat. And then when you need it, you can use it to boil water and generate electricity. And yeah, there's a lot of progress with all kinds of energy storage systems. And one of the criticisms of wind and solar is that they're intermittent. You know, the sun doesn't shine at night or when it's real cloudy. So the solar panels don't work and the wind isn't always blowing. And you can partially compensate for that by having a smart grid that can move the power to where it's needed from where it's being generated at different times and places. But also you need to store it. So when the sun is blazing, you're getting more electricity than needs to be used at that point. You want to store that energy. And so all these different systems for storing energy are developing very fast. So that should not be a problem for wind and solar, even though they're intermittent. You just need the storage systems and a smart grid that can move the power to where it's needed from where it's being generated or stored. Via email, comments on Giuliani's $148 million sentence for defaming election workers in Georgia. You know, that jerk deserves it. He's going to appeal. He doesn't have the money, so these women may never get paid. But, you know, he's ruined. Former America's mayor, who is always a jerk. He never admitted his mistakes. He often, you know, demonized people for his own political gain when he was mayor of New York. His policing policies were very, part of the mass incarceration problem and part of the problem of police brutality. So, you know, under Giuliani, you may remember Abner Louima, a Haitian guy that was sodomized with a nightstick by New York police and who reportedly said, we can do this because it's Giuliani time. That's who that guy really is. And, so he deserves what he's getting. And he's got a lot more coming. He's got a lot of legal problems. He's ruined. I mean, he was on top of the world and a millionaire, multimillionaire. And now he's down in the gutter where he really always behaved. And it caught up with him and good. Kerry Campbell, what happened to the new Green Party affiliate in Alaska, the Aurora Party? I was not directly in touch with them. I think some of those people we may have been in touch with at one point. And I think they're at a pretty low level of organization. They do have some people and they went through the process. And what they did was Cornel West paid for a ballot access guy that the Greens have used. I used him in 2020. He's actually a libertarian, but he's good at doing ballot access petitioning with his crew up there. And Cornel West got a ballot line. So the Aurora Party is apparently just going with Cornel West. So I don't think they've been affiliated formally to the Green Party of the United States. I think they were getting ready to do that application. But if they're running somebody else than the Green Party nominee, that'll be a problem for them. So I guess the question then becomes, well, what's Jill Stein going to do if she's the nominee? I think she's going to pay the same guy to get another ballot line for the Green nominee. So, well, I think we'll get on a ballot in Alaska. The cost is reasonable as these things go. It's between $10,000 and $15,000. So I don't think that'll be a problem. It's just unfortunate. But I don't know the players in the Aurora Party. And I've had no discussion. Jenny says they formed for Wes. But I think they were thinking that they wanted to be part of the Green Party. And some of those people, I believe we talked to earlier, you know, after my campaign, after, you know, the Green Party of Alaska was expelled because one guy took it over. He didn't let, you know, the rest of the membership vote, and he gave the nomination that Angela Walker and I ran for that line, and my campaign paid for the ballot line and gave it to the wrestler, Jesse Ventura, and Cynthia McKinney, who's become a conspiracy nut. And this one guy just did it on his own. So the National Party, and one of the conditions of being an affiliated state party is you have to put the nominee of the national convention on your ballot line. So Alaska, you know, was in violation for that. Plus, it was not Democratic, small d. It was just this one guy's little fiefdom. And he had a couple people working with him, but most of the Alaska Greens couldn't even find out when to vote when they were voting on who to send delegates to the national convention and who the delegates should support to the national convention. And then, you know, they ignored that anyway when they put Ventura on the ballot. So that's what happened in Alaska. Via email, did you read the reports about SCOTUS and the Dobbs decision? I'm not sure which reports you're referring to. You'll have to give me more. I guess there was a concern that some of those Republican justices have received financial support and gifts from right-wing billionaires, concerned about the process and how the votes went down. Well, no, I actually haven't seen those reports. Those reports on how the discussion in the background, New York Times reporting this week. Okay, I guess I should go back and read that. I haven't read those reports. The email, thoughts on the Biden impeachment inquiry. Yeah, it's just another, the Republicans in the House are nuts. I guess they're claiming there was bribes to Hunter Biden and Joe Biden from some shady guy in Burisma in Ukraine. And they claim to have audio tapes, but they never produce them. There's no evidence for this. The inquiry, I guess they're going to go on a witch hunt or a hunting expedition to find evidence. But it's very different than Trump. I think what's going to happen is this is going to be like the Clinton impeachment. I mean, Clinton actually did, have sexual relations with an intern, which is a problem. But it was clear the Republicans were on a political mission on that, and the general public reacted negatively. And so, the standing of the Democrats went up during that period. So I think that may be what happens this time. The Republicans are so, divorced from reality that I think a lot of Americans are going to say these people are crazy and we don't want any part of them, which is going to hurt not just their presidential ticket, but their candidates in districts that are potentially competitive. B.D. Dimmitt, there was work years ago toward providing cars with doors and ceilings that would function as electricity storage and the use of high energy production periods to separate water for hydrogen is again a thing. Yeah, I think you're right about that. As far as the hydrogen goes, all I'm arguing is that it shouldn't all go toward hydrogen because there are more cost and energy efficient ways of storing energy that can later be used to produce electricity. And then doors and ceilings that would function as electricity storage. I'm not sure, I'm not familiar with what you're talking about. And I'm trying to think what form that could be in, unless that's where you sort of spread the battery out, over the whole shell of the car rather than just have a battery, you know, in the trunk or in the engine compartments. Ashley R. Kerry isn't Biden, by the way. He'd be able to do much more as climate captain with a Sanders delayed ticket, for example. Well, you have more faith in Kerry than I do. I actually met him 1972, January 1972, and we were both in Vietnam Veterans Against the War, except he quit that to join another veterans group that was not so much against the war. And he struck me at that time as an ambitious guy that wanted to be another Kennedy kind of guy from Massachusetts. And that's what he became, you know, part of that generation of Democrats that scrapped the New Deal and went to neoliberal capitalism. But, you know, if he was the climate czar for, a Sanders-Tlaib administration, which, you know, would certainly be an improvement over what we got now, he'd have to, you know, follow their direction. And I don't know what's, you know, in his heart, in his mind, as far as climate action goes. I think he's an establishment guy that sort of wants to push within the limits that the establishment will allow, which is, you know, the big oil and gas companies, as well as other big corporate interests that are afraid of the disruptions that are, you know, real Green New Deal, trying to meet a rapid timeline for 100% clean energy and zero emissions to address what the climate crisis requires. So I guess I'd agree with you. He'd be better under a Sanders-Tlaib administration than a Biden administration. But I don't think Sanders-Tlaib would pick him. I think they'd pick somebody who was much more aggressive on climate action to deal with the other countries. William Parmalee, is there a way to get the Green Party candidate into the debates? Well, it's interesting. The Republicans, their national committee, and Donald Trump himself have said they're not going to participate in the debates that have been hosted since the 80s by the Commission on Presidential Debates, which sounds like a government agency, but in fact is a private corporation that's jointly owned by Democratic and Republican leaders. And they set that up and kind of muscled out the League of Women Voters after John Anderson got in the national debate in 1980, and the two major parties didn't like that. So I don't know what's going to happen if the Commission on Presidential Debates is ignored by the Republicans. Are they going to go ahead? Now, their criteria to get into a debate are pretty difficult. You have to be polling at 15% or more in, I forget the number of major polls, but they pick the polls. You have to have raised a certain amount of money. It's something that almost by definition, a Green candidate would be excluded from. But, you know, if the Commission on Presidential Debates can't get a Republican there, maybe they'd open it up. On the other hand, they're really a two-party organization to keep minor parties out. Maybe that will open the door for the League of Women Voters to host a debate and include the Green Party in the interest of debate. We were able to do that here in New York in 2018 when the governor, Andrew Cuomo, would not debate. He finally had some snap debates on the radio with the Republican candidate. But we convinced the League of Women Voters to have an all-comers, all candidates on the ballot debate. And everybody showed up but the Democrat. The Republican showed up. I showed up. The Libertarian showed up. Former mayor of the city running with a kind of corporate centrist party showed up. And by the way, I beat my mayor here in Syracuse in the county and in the state. Even though she was in a well-funded campaign by these corporate centrists. Which is just to say, you know, I came in third out of five candidates that year. The Green Party is no joke because our platform is popular. People want Medicare for all. They want a Green New Deal. They want the tax, the rich taxed. And that's why the Democrats try so hard to keep us off the ballot and out of debates. So is there a way? I think, you know, maybe this year, because the Republicans have told the Commission on Presidential Debates they're not participating. So that may open the door for a civic group like the League of Women Voters or, you know, the media to hold their debates on their terms rather than with the Commission on Presidential Debates. So, and it is an interesting year where, relative to other years, the third party candidates are higher in the polls. Kennedy for sure, West and Stein. I looked at these polls recently for an article I was writing. They're getting between 1% and 4% each. It's closer to 4% when it's a national poll. It's closer to 1% when it's a poll in a competitive battleground state. But that's, you know, that's significant in an election that might be close between the Democrats and Republicans, plus the Kennedy factor, who appears now to be taking more from the right than the left because he's moved to the right on immigration, on Israel, and his anti-vax nonsense. So, you know, it creates an interesting situation where debates would be clarifying for the public and maybe the media or civic organizations will set them up. So I think, you know, we should be hopeful and we should push for that. B.D. Dimmitt, the main reason the Commission on Presidential Debates was allowed to take control of debates as a bipartisan organization in a job that was to be available only to nonpartisan organizations was that they were in the position to ensure that the candidates would participate. Well, they may have been initially, but, you know, the Republicans, you know, they're just not cooperating with anybody except themselves, and they can't even do it among themselves. So the Commission on Presidential Debates is, you know, maybe headed for the dustbin of history. You know, we'll have to see. But if the Republicans won't participate in their debate, you know, their purpose is outlived. Okay, we talked a lot about the Green New Deal and the presidential race, not much about the war going on in Israel-Palestine, which kind of surprises me, but I guess I don't need to, you know, remind you that we need to be active on that, because that's the immediate crisis where lots of people are being killed. And, you know, unless we move to a ceasefire and a political process toward a resolution of the conflict, this is going to be a recurring and long-term problem that, you know, could flare into a regional war and even a world war. So we got to stay active on that issue. And then, you know, the climate issue that we talked about, that's why we need, you know, more green candidates. And, you know, we should all be, when the opportunity arises, you're writing letters to the editor, op-eds, speaking out in public hearings, public forums, organizing public forums. In other words, you know, a lot of activism on this because there's a lot of complacency with the Democrats and Republicans on the climate issue. The Democrats say we did that. The Republicans say we don't want to do it. And the fact is it hasn't been done. And so we're the ones that got to make it happen. So, you know, stay active, as I keep saying. You know, our activism makes a difference. And oftentimes we're gaining, even though it isn't apparent at the current moment. But, you know, we're changing people's minds and social change comes in leaps. Suddenly everybody seems to be with you and things move. So keep the faith and stay active. And I will be here next week. It's, let's see, it's the 23rd, the eve of Christmas Eve. I'm not sure I have the technical backup. So, you know, stay tuned to our social media to see if next week we're actually going to be on. We're working on that, but we may not have the people who can, you know, do the technical background to this, which I can't do on my own. Maybe I should learn how to do that, but I haven't. So same thing goes for the eve of New Year's Eve. I plan to be here, but, you know, stay on our Facebook or Twitter feed to see, you know, if we're actually on next week. In the meantime, have a good week, and we'll see you soon.